Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Point of Insanity Game Studios, Geekery in General podcast. And today we're going to be taking a look at a time period in British history, the Victorian age, and explore some ideas for how you might run a Dungeons & Dragons campaign in this particular time setting. Now, the Victorian age is named for Queen Victoria, who reigned from 1837 until her death in 1901. Now, during this time, there was a great emphasis on etiquette and social structure, as well as a great emphasis on self-improvement and hard work. And it was an interesting time in that, while there was a lot of advancement in science and medicine, and also this is a time when we saw the roots of forensic science start to develop as well. And there was also a lot of great literature that was written in this time, not just in England, but other parts of Europe as well. For the poor, though, things weren't always so pretty and so nice. They often had to work long hours in dangerous mills or factories for low pay. And while there were some reforms made during this time to try to help the poor, it wasn't always enough. Now, for the poorest of the poor, there were workhouses, and this is where orphans, the very poor, and other undesirables would go for food and shelter. Conditions in these houses were not great, as one of the prevailing attitudes during this time was, at least especially in the upper class, was that poverty was something you deserved. So if you were poor, it meant, well, you either made stupid decisions or, you know, maybe you were just a bad person, but you deserved it. So there was this attitude that the poor were meant to be not seen, not heard from. They were meant to be invisible. But yet these poor people also did a lot of important jobs working in the factories and the mills. Now, getting back to the workhouses, these were meant to try to shock people out of poverty. Back then, they probably saw it as taking the tough love approach. See, if you went to one of these workhouses, first, you were given very sparse accommodations, certainly not much privacy in there. Families were also separated as well. And you would often be forced to work long hours doing hard, backbreaking labor, and you really didn't get much food for it. So, like I said, the belief was that, you know, if you force these poor people to do long hours of hard, backbreaking work for not much in return, it would make them want to get out of these houses and, you know, go get jobs and stop being poor. Now, another thing that we see during this time period is the Industrial Revolution. During this time, the population started to move from rural areas into the cities, which led to some problems that we're going to be talking about during the show today. Now, one of the problems with this growing urban population was, well, sanitation was a big concern. Well, before this time, some larger cities like London did have sewers. It's just that it wasn't enough to deal with the growing number of people. And not only that, there was also the coal-burning mills and factories that also led to a lot of pollution as well. And due to poor sanitation conditions, it wasn't unusual for disease outbreaks to overcome parts of the city because they were polluting the River Thames, or Thames, I think that's how it's pronounced. But they were polluting the river that was one of their main sources of drinking water. So it's an era where you've got the good and you've got the bad. So we'll talk a little bit about some ways to run a campaign in Victorian England in just a moment.
Welcome to Bone Throwers Theater. Nah, it's not that kind of show. It's an RPG actual play podcast. My name is Jordan, and I'm joined by our fun-loving cast.
This is Aaron.
Jeff here.
Johnny is my name.
And I'm Jeremy. And what we do is dive in and play various tabletop RPG systems and games, such as Mini Six,
Fiasco,
Inspectors,
Monster of the Week,
Fate, and more.
But no matter the rule set or setting, some pretty intense storytelling hits the fan.
So whether you like epic fantasy adventure,
comedy,
sci-fi,
horror,
or just horrifically bad puns,
we've got something to feast your imagination on.
Listen to our full episodes and more at bonethrowerstheater.com.
And may the bones fall ever in your favor.
And we're back. Now, before I begin, I'm probably going to be using England a lot during this because I am going to be focusing on that part of the United Kingdom. Yes, I do know there are other parts of the UK. In addition to England, there's Wales, as well as Northern Ireland, Scotland. So, like I said, I'm going to be focusing mostly on the area, England. Now, maybe, I don't know, maybe in the future I might do historical gaming episodes on Ireland or Scotland. Again, I know a little bit about, very little bit about Irish mythology and folklore. Actually, I'm also I really like Irish folk music as well. That's my primarily, exposure to Irish heritage and culture. Scotland, don't really know too much about Scotland. I did see Braveheart, but I'm sure that movie probably has a lot of historical inaccuracies. You know, because unfortunately with Hollywood, when they are making these historical pieces, they're not always very accurate. But that's another topic for another time. But getting back to Dungeons & Dragons, first let's talk about how to incorporate the different classes in this time period. Now, of course, fighters are going to be pretty easy. Main thing you're just going to have to keep in mind is just the weapons and armor of the era. As far as armor, from what I could tell, pretty much non-existent because of the number of guns and the development of firearms. Well, people really didn't really wear armor. You know, maybe if they did wear armor, it was ceremonial, but it's not something that you were going to wear on an everyday basis, and it certainly wasn't something that you were going to wear into battle. Now, I mentioned firearms. So there were several types of rifles that were in service in the British Army during this time. There was the Pattern 1853 Enfield, which this was the primary muzzle-loading rifle of the British Army that saw service until around 1867. It was eventually phased out in favor of the Snyder Enfield rifle. So here's where we move to a cartridge-based rifle, which allowed for a better rate of fire as well as more reliable shots. This would eventually be replaced by the Martini Henry rifles, which were more accurate and also had a longer range. And this rifle would actually see service well after the Victorian era up until World War I. Now, they also used different types of pistols and revolvers. Again, you had your single shot muzzle loading pistols, but we did start to see revolvers begin to develop around this time as well. However, this doesn't mean that a fighter, specifically a soldier, would be limited to just guns, of course. They were also trained in the use of swords as well. And one of the reasons is because during this time, you know, your rifles and your firearms were, you know, most of them were single shot. You know, again, you had your revolvers. You also had your, you know, those were multi-shot, of course. And then you did also have Gatling gun, machine gun type weapons. But obviously, you're not just going to be carrying one of those down the street with you. And as far as I know, I think a lot of the breech-loading rifles that they had at this time were also single-shot. I'm not quite sure if they had magazine-fed rifles at this time. So, you know, there was a good chance if in a battle that eventually ranks would close and you wouldn't be able to use your firearm and you'd have to switch to a melee weapon. And as I mentioned before, they're also prone to failure. Now, I've done muzzle-loading, and while muzzle-loading rifles can be fun to shoot, they don't always fire. Because what happens is, you know, you have your percussion cap, and, you know, when you pull the trigger and the cap, you know, hits the firing mechanism, it's supposed to shoot a spark down a little tube. And that's going to ignite the gunpowder and cause the boom. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work. So that's one of the things we always had to be careful about when shooting muzzle loaders. You know, after you fired a shot, if it, you know, you might try another percussion cap, but if it didn't work, then you'd usually want to wait a little bit for, you know, the, you know, to make sure it doesn't go off while you're trying to clear the rifle. Another thing you'd have, well, however, they were certainly a big improvement from the earlier flintlocks. And one of the, I was talking to a guy many years ago. I was a part of an explorer post, and sometimes we would go to rendezvous, which would, they were like frontiersmen. You know, you could learn a lot about how pioneers and other frontiersmen would live. And one of the guys I was talking to was mentioning with people who do a lot of flintlock shooting, they tend to develop very, very steady hands because when you pull the trigger on a flintlock, it doesn't always fire right away. And sometimes you do have to wait a few seconds before the powder will ignite and the gun will shoot. So again, you learn how to be very careful and very patient with those rifles. So one way you could incorporate fighters is soldiers. So one of the biggest ways a fighter could find employment during this time would be to join the military. Soldiers were very important during the Victorian age because during this time, the British Empire occupied many different countries in different parts of the world. They had a presence in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India, parts of Indonesia, Africa, and parts of South America as well. So obviously they would need these soldiers to be able to fight battles as well as once a land has been taken over and conquered to keep the presence there. However, if you didn't want to do a strictly military-themed campaign, a policeman would be another good option for a fighter. One of the problems that came with the increasing urban population was an increase in crime. So during this time, the government decided that it would be beneficial to start developing a police force. And eventually they would hope that, you know, every large city would have its own policeman. Now, these police officers rarely had access to firearms. So their primary weapon is they were trained in a short club called a truncheon. However, they also trained in the use of a short, curved sword called a hanger. These swords were interesting because they had a little mechanism built into the hilt, so that required you to press a button in order for this little mechanism to release so you could draw the sword. And this was done as a security measure because there may be times where a policeman was in close quarters, and it would prevent someone from easily drawing the sword. However, unlike the sword that a soldier would use, a policeman's sword tended to be blunt or not as well sharpened. Because again, as a policeman, they, you know, their primary, you know, goal was usually to subdue and control as opposed to just kill somebody. Another thing that was interesting about their uniforms is they often wore something similar to a top hat, and then they also wore a tailed coat. And the reason for this was that it was supposed to represent their roles, where usually a top hat, you know, or the style of headwear they used was worn by people who were in positions of power or authority. So that represented the policeman's role as an arm of the government, as a symbol of authority. However, the tailed coat they usually wore, that was something that was usually associated with servants. So while it's saying, yeah, we've got the power and we've got authority, we're also here to serve you and protect you and help you. Now, as far as the common man and what weapons he would use, well, the common person probably didn't really carry any weapons, and they would tend to favor things like axes or hammers that could double as tools, or weapons like knives, because again, you could use a knife as a tool, or weapons that could be easily improvised, like clubs. Stick fighting was also something that was practiced around this time, generally a cane. So there were people that did study ways to use the cane as, you know, a walking stick as an offensive weapon. Now, moving on to other classes. First, the paladin. I couldn't really think of a way to work that into Victorian England, because again, by this time, the days of, mounted combat, well, there was still mounted combat, but, the days of the knight in shining armor on his gallant war horse, his horse decked out in shining armor, those days were long gone. So the ideas of chivalry and, holy service, yeah, those, I couldn't really think of any way to work that into this type of campaign. Same thing with a ranger, because, yeah, there was still going to be the rural areas that weren't being developed. So as far as I could, at least in my opinion, probably the best way to do a ranger in this type of campaign would be a scout in the army. Though if you are playing second edition D&D and you've got the complete Ranger's Handbook, they do have a type of ranger in there called the Stalker, who is an urban ranger. So that might be another possibility. Now, moving on to the monk. This is a type of character class that I've sometimes had trouble working into historical settings, because the idea of this, bare-handed, empty-handed fighter, practicing all these exotic and beautiful moves, not always going to be appropriate to every type of campaign. However, I think it would actually work out quite well in a Victorian England setting. First, bare-knuckle boxing was a popular sport around this time. And you've probably seen pictures of bare-knuckle boxers. Usually they have it's a picture of a very manly man with an epic mustache. And sometimes people will put, phrases underneath like, hardcore punk, you mean softcore thrash, or Chuck Norris, never heard of her. They actually used a very different fighting stance, though, than what modern boxers did. Probably the best example I could think of, if you are familiar with the basketball team, the Boston Celts, their mascot is this, Irishman with his fists up in a, put him up type stance. So that was actually not too different from the type of stance that these fighters would use. And they actually didn't hit with their knuckles as much, because your knuckles are actually quite fragile. So they would try to hit with different parts of the hand. Because remember, at this time, bare-knuckled boxing, they didn't have gloves. So you had to be very careful with how you threw your punches. However, there's another option for a character wanting to play a monk or a martial artist. Around this, the later part of the Victorian age, there was a martial art called Bartitsu, and this was the gentleman's art of self-defense. It was founded by a man named Edward Barton Wright. He was an engineer, and he worked in Japan for a few years, and while there, learned a little bit of jujitsu and a little bit of judo. Now, this martial art was only really in, he was really only taught and in practice towards the very end of the Victorian era. I think he closed down his school in like 1902, and he started just a couple years beforehand. So again, unfortunately, there was a very short period that Barton taught his art. Now, it may have been forgotten entirely if it wasn't for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. In one of his Sherlock Holmes stories, he mentions that that the detective had some knowledge of the art, which he also referred to as Japanese wrestling. He also incorrectly referred to it as Baritsu. Now, as I said, it was very sad that this art didn't really catch on, because in many ways, Barton was very much ahead of his time. Some people like to say that Bruce Lee, if not the first mixed martial artist, is at least the father of mixed martial arts. Because one of the things Bruce Lee was known for doing is he would say, you know, he thought it was good to practice lots of martial arts and take what you want, disregard the rest. So he would do things like, you know, he had Wing Chun was the first style he studied, but, you know, he also studied a little bit of grappling and took some of the holds from that. And he also took some techniques he liked from Taekwondo and karate. And he also incorporated footwork from fencing as well. However, Barton had him beat. There's some people that would say that he is actually the first mixed martial art or mixed martial artist, because when he was creating Bartitsu, he combined aspects of judo, savate, which is French kickboxing, jujitsu, boxing, fencing, knife fighting, and cane fighting. He also taught self-defense to women's suffrage activists. He also was known to arrange fights between practitioners of different styles. So take that, UFC. Now, when he did these cross art promotions, he would often have his jujitsu students or jujitsu fighters fight against Greco-Roman wrestlers. And usually these Greco-Roman wrestlers didn't fare too well against jujitsu, because the submission style that these jujitsu fighters learned was unlike anything they had ever seen. So not only did Barton become the first person, or at least one of the first people, to teach Asian martial arts in London, he was also known for combining Western and Eastern martial arts. And Bartitsu was actually developed for a very specific purpose, for use in the streets. Primarily, it was developed to help defend against muggings. I saw a couple of videos, talked a little bit about Bartitsu, as it has seen a resurgence in the last few years. One of the key elements of this art was actually distraction as a self-defense technique. So this could include things like throwing a handkerchief or a jacket in an opponent's face and then sucker punching him while, you know, he was distracted. Another one of the things he would teach is aggressive defense. And this was modifying blocks so it would cause an attacker to hurt himself if he tried to punch or kick you. So those are just a couple options for people who want to play monks or monk-like characters. Now, as we move to the priestly classes, first clerics, most likely they would have belonged to the Church of England, though there were, you know, of course, other various denominations of Christianity that were active at this time. There were, of course, Catholics and Protestants, and unfortunately, they didn't always get along. There were sometimes conflicts between different denominations of Christianity. As far as how you would play a cleric character, I think that would be challenging because, again, at least as far as I can tell, they would be more or less expected to, mind their church, you know, help their parishioners. Though I could see having a cleric be like a chaplain for the police force, if you are going to focus on a more urban, you know, city-focused campaign, or if you are choosing the route where most of your characters are going to be part of the British Army, they could be a chaplain in the military. Well, next, let's go to Druids. And this is another one of those classes that I've often had a hard time finding a way to fit into the non-European settings. They would actually fit because during the Victorian era, there were people who called themselves Druids. Now, attempts to revive Druidic beliefs can be traced far back as the 1700s, though it was more of a cultural movement as opposed to a religious one. So nowadays, most people, when they hear Druid, at least in modern terms, they're thinking of a neo-pagan religion. Usually that's very, you know, nature-oriented in its worship. But this didn't have to be the case with Druids around this time, as many early Druids in this movement did consider themselves Christian. So like I said, this was a Celtic revival that was just as much about art and music as it was about religion and philosophy. This movement pictured the Celts as the noble savage, someone from a primitive culture that had not yet been corrupted by the modern world. However, reconstructing their beliefs was difficult back then, just as it can be challenging now, because the Druids left no written records about themselves. Any literary works that would have been available at this time came from the Greeks and Romans, who didn't always take a favorable view of them because they were usually fighting against the Celts. So as far as I can tell, they had a belief in elemental spirits, and also it was possible to communicate with these spirits as well as, you know, fairies or similar nature type spirits. It is also possible they sought to emulate the Druid's role as a lore keeper and healer. So a Druid would probably be better suited for the areas outside the city, of course. So I could easily picture a Druid character at this time being someone who lived in a more rural area, perhaps serving as a small village's, you know, doctor, as well as, you know, a judiciary figure, because Druids did have that role as the, you know, a lawgiver in their communities. Well, next, let's take a look at the rogue classes, the thieves and the bards. Now, because of the movement of population from rural areas to the city, this did cause a huge population boom, which caused a problem with crime. There wasn't always enough affordable housing, so it wasn't unusual for people to be living in these close, cramped spaces. So a rise in crime was unavoidable. Pickpockets and burglars were very common, and sometimes these gangs would employ children either as pickpockets or accomplices in their crime. So usually it was the child that would distract a potential victim, while the more experienced pickpocket would try to sneak in and you know, grab his purse from behind. Another tactic was to use a prostitute to lure a victim away from potential onlookers. Sometimes a man would even try to distract someone by disguising himself as a woman to catch someone off guard. If a mugger could obtain chloroform, he might have used a handkerchief soaked with this chemical as a way to help him incapacitate a victim. Now, of course, a thief could also certainly hire himself as an assassin, and even Queen Victoria herself was subject to a few assassination attempts. Poison was another common murder weapon when it could be obtained, especially arsenic, and it was effective because, again, at this time, forensic science was still very young, and it wasn't until later in this era that scientists started to develop reliable methods to detect poisoning. Bards would also fit in very well, as music was a popular and very easily accessible form of entertainment. There were saloons and music halls where one could not only listen to music, but also see plays and dances. And of course, there's lots of different types of folk dances and types of plays you would see back then. For example, there was the Mummers play, and these were performed by actors wearing masks. And then various types of folk dance, like Morris dancing. Further north, you know, in Scotland, there was the Scottish sword dance, and I think there were people that did also practice more, you know, aggressive forms of sword dancing, where, you know, they would look something like a form you would do in a martial art. And since, again, the British Empire did span to different countries, you know, you could certainly bring in someone who is, let's say, you know, a belly dancer, someone who studied more Mideastern types of dance. So they would certainly be a very exotic and very popular type of dancer. And again, if you're choosing to focus your campaign on the military, I'm sure that the British military back then did employ spies and information gatherers. So that would be another legitimate use for a thief or a bard-like character. Well, next, let's talk about wizards. And again, this is one of those classes that sometimes can be hard to work into a historical campaign. But it can be done. Despite the increase in science and industry, there was still a belief during this time in the supernatural. One type of belief was called mesmerism. And this was a belief that you could manipulate the flow of magnetic energy between people for healing purposes. There was also spiritualism, and this was a belief that you could communicate with spirits. Now, of course, many people who performed these acts were charlatans who used various tricks to make their customers think that there was, in fact, a ghost communicating with them. Now, in my hometown here, at the Appleton Historical Society, they do have an exhibit about the famous stage magician Harry Houdini. And he actually made it one of his purposes or one of his goals to try to expose these charlatans whenever he could. And they actually have an interesting little part of that exhibit where they do point out some of the tricks that these spiritualists would use to make people think they were contacting the dead. Now, there were magical orders back then that performed various types of ceremonial magic. Perhaps the most well-known is the Order of the Golden Dawn. They would perform elaborate rituals that often required a variety of tools. Often, the purpose of these rituals was spiritual development or connecting with a divine entity like a god or an angel. And usually their rituals incorporated Egyptian clothing and symbols into their rituals they were performing. It was founded in the late 1800s. And perhaps one of the most well-known practitioners within the Order of the Golden Dawn was Aleister Crowley. Now, despite the fact that a lot of people probably associate Crowley with the Golden Dawn, he actually wasn't involved in that group for a very long time. He was only in it for about a year or so, so he was still very low in the ranks. Some of the practices within the Order of the Golden Dawn included tarot, divination, scrying, astral projection, astrology, and alchemy. Now, this order was a hermetic order. It was based on the teachings of a figure known as Hermes Trismegistus, or Hermes the Thrice Greatest. He may have been associated with the Greek god Hermes and the Egyptian god Thoth. Another theory is that he was a wise prophet who knew the three parts of the universe: alchemy, astrology, and theurgy. I think that's how it's pronounced. But it was believed that these three areas of study represented knowledge of the sun, the stars, and the divine. So I would recommend, if you are going to allow wizards in your campaign, probably want to have them shy away from a lot of your direct damage spells. But some of the other spells could be permissible. Now, depending on the nature of the spell, and since a lot of the magic they perform was rituals as opposed to, you know, stuff that a typical D&D adventuring wizard would use, one idea you could incorporate comes from one of the second edition historical supplements called A Mighty Fortress, where they do have a white wizard kit in there, and they suggested that what you would do is you would increase the casting time of the different rituals that, or the different spells. And that's to simulate the fact that they're not, you know, their spells are actually being cast through these rituals where, you know, usually you'd have to prepare the area, you know, you'd have to create your circle. And after you create your circle, then you might have to, you know, enter a meditative trance and maybe burn some incense or combine some of your spell components into a cauldron. And then at the end of the ritual, you'd have to dismiss your circle and any powers that you've summoned. So that's why, again, I think it would make sense, because it would take, you know, it's not just, okay, I'm going to cast sleep on someone, so I pull out my handful of sand and say my magic words. No, you have this big ritual. So yeah, it's going to very much limit the effectiveness of a lot of your spells. Now let's move on to monsters. Now, I think that some of the monsters from a little earlier era, there was a belief in vampires and werewolves. So I think those would work, because since you might be dealing with primarily an urban setting, it's easy to picture, you know, a vampire or a werewolf prowling the streets of, you know, London at night. And you could also draw upon earlier traditions of elves and fae creatures, though from what I understand around this time, fairy tales gave way to ghost stories as the, you know, one of the primary forms of storytelling. There's actually a lot of belief in ghost dogs from around this time. There have been many reported sightings of black dogs. These are ghostly dogs that usually served as omens of doom. In some cases, they would attack people. However, some were actually helpful. And there was one story I remember reading about. There was a man who was lost in the woods, and this big black dog came up by him. And the dog only stayed with him until he left the forest. And then later he found out that there were some highwaymen, yet another way you could use a thief character, of course, but there were some highwaymen that were captured, and they said they would have mugged him and killed him. It's just that there was this big, intimidating black dog with him, and they didn't want to risk coming in contact with that dog. There's also a belief of a type of ghost called a church grim. This was a ghost of a dog whose duty it was to protect the church from vandals, thieves, and defilers. So, because of the popularity of ghost stories, introducing various non-corporeal undead would not be out of place. And because you're probably not going to have a lot of magic or magic weapons in this type of campaign, they would be very formidable foes indeed. Another idea comes from a story written around this time. The Island of Dr. Moreau was written in 1896. So again, within the Victorian era. But in this story, he created human-animal hybrids. So that might be another interesting type of monster. I also read a little bit about a creature from British folklore called Spring-Heeled Jack. He could take many different forms. Usually he had a very devil-like or monstrous appearance. He was called Spring-Heeled Jack because of the great leaps he could make. It was said that he would also breathe out white and blue fire. He often wore a cloak and a white leathery garment, and other reports say that he had sharp claws. So that's another type of, again, I could see him very easily working in an urban campaign. Another type of enemy that you could introduce would be mysterious serial killers in the vein of Jack the Ripper. Because remember, Jack the Ripper was never caught. And while there are some theories as to who he was, we really don't know for certain who he was and, you know, how many people he actually did manage to kill. You know, there's a, I think, like about a, like 8 or 10 or so people who were attributed to him, but it's always possible he could have killed even more people. So that might be another idea, this, you know, mysterious serial killer who has a almost supernatural ability to escape the police and commit his crimes unnoticed. Perhaps he has access to some form of magic, and that's why he's able to get away with all these crimes. Or maybe he's not of this world. Now, when we decide how we want to run our campaign in Victorian England, we could also look to some of other H.G. Wells's works for inspiration. Some of the other books he wrote around this time included The Time Machine and The Invisible Man, War of the Worlds, When the Sleeper Wakes, and The First Men in the Moon. You could also look to some of the works from French author Jules Verne, you know, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, as an example, or other stories we can look to, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Dracula, Around the World in 80 Days. These were all pieces of literature that were written sometime during the Victorian age. So this is where we see the roots of science fiction. And if you're a fan of steampunk, this is where I think it draws a lot of the inspiration from. So one of the things I think is fascinating about this time period is, since science was starting to become, you know, more advanced and starting to move forward, there were a lot of ideas about what science could do. And again, it was possibly because since it was still fairly primitive, at least by today's standards, you know, it was easy to really make up things and, you know, think, hey, maybe it is possible to make a potion that turns you invisible. So in addition to drawing upon science fiction, another way you could run the campaign, and this would be the best if you're going to be, well, that's if you decided you wanted to do the military as a focus for the campaign, you know, perhaps the party, maybe they grew up on the lower end of the social ladder, and maybe one day during, you know, a trip to the pub, they were listening to a grizzled old soldier who, you know, talked about his various travels. You know, maybe he described the beauty of the Canadian wilderness, or the exotic cultures of India, or the unusual animals of Australia. You know, these are things that could have made the characters want to join the military, or maybe if they weren't joining the military, but had, you know, actual money and wealth, maybe that could inspire them to travel to some of these other places. And if you're looking for ideas and how to run campaigns in those areas, you're in luck, because in the past I have done historical gaming episodes on India as well as Australia. And for the Canadian part of it, well, my friend James and I, many, many episodes ago, did do an episode on Native American cultures and how you might incorporate those into gaming as well. Well, that's all I have to say about the topic for now. So I hope that you found this information informative and entertaining, and maybe it'll make you think of ways to adopt your favorite D&D rule setting into Victorian England. Because like I said, it was a very interesting time in that there was, you know, all these advances in science and technology and medicine. And since, you know, the British Empire did spread around to several parts of the world, that would have put them in in contact with many different types of cultures and, you know, exotic people and locations. Well, with that said, I'd like to thank you for tuning in and have a good evening or morning or afternoon, whatever it is, wherever you are, and happy gaming.
You have been listening to a program from the Point of Insanity Network. Visit us at poigamestudio.podbean.com for more shows. Follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at POI Game Studio.